Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Mana Spike Podcast. I am your host, Eric Sias. With me, as always, are my wonderful co-hosts, Jay Anketel.
Hey, how's it going this week?
Adrian Lopez.
I'm Adrian.
And William Hendricks.
Unfortunately, he is Adrian.
So, we're really sorry that we couldn't put out an episode last week. We had some technical difficulties that prevented us from putting out an episode with good audio quality in order for you guys to hear, but we're here this week, and hopefully the quality has been fixed, and we're good to go. So, how have you guys been? It's been a while since we talked. It's been a while since anybody's heard from us.
Yeah, it hasn't been that long, okay? I talked to you guys, like, yesterday.
No, I mean, we saw each other yesterday.
But we didn't talk.
There was no words. Just body language.
It was that awkward moment in public where you don't want other people to know that you're friends with nerdy people?
No, it was more like, you know, when you have a friend on Facebook, but and you both know your friends on Facebook, but you don't talk to each other? Like that.
Yeah. Just like that.
Yeah.
You did a really good job of...
I really painted a picture there.
The awkwardness.
So, this past week was a really busy week for me, in terms of Magic. I got to play on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So on Thursday, too much Magic.
It was a lot of Magic. So on Thursday, I played in my local Modern tournament, and I played Gerard Fabiano's Sultai list, and I took it all the way to the finals, and I decided to split in the finals, because it was 1:30 in the morning, and I didn't want to play another round. But the deck is really, really good and it's very strong, and I felt like I didn't have any terrible matchups. So I really like the deck a lot. I like it so much, in fact, because I borrowed it. So I like it so much that I'm actually going to build it, and I'm slowly accumulating pieces for the deck so I can actually have it and own it. And then on Friday...
But however will you get the Termagoyps for that deck?
Well, we're going to lead into that because...
Foreshadow.
Spoiler alert, Tarmogoyf is getting reprinted in Modern Masters 2015.
You ruined the foreshadowing!
And what's the point of laying the foundation of this expertly, artisanly crafted foreshadowing if you're just going to immediately, like, just yank the curtain up and expose Adrian for the fraud that he is?
I don't know. It's fine, I guess. Anyway, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday were all standard tournaments. Sunday was a GPT for Las Vegas. I have one buy already. I was trying to get my second. And all 3 days I played the red-white mid-range deck, or some people are saying red-white control, whatever it is. The red-white deck, and I played Ben Stark's list. I played his exact 75 with his recommendation of cutting the Mastery of the Unseen for Ashcloud Phoenixes. And I rolled with that, and I did really well. So on Friday, I top 8 but lost to Mono Red in top 8. Saturday, I split in top 4 with all the other top 4 competitors. We split a box. And then Sunday, I lost in top 4 to none other than Adrian.
Oh, that's me. That's me.
That's Adrian.
That's gotta be embarrassing.
But you did lose. I did lose to you in Swiss.
Well, you kind of scooped me into the top eight, which is cool. So
I'm a good friend.
It was pretty awesome. Because no one was drawing in the Swiss, which was really awkward. Like, everyone was just, like, fighting for, like, jockeying for that first seed. Nobody was drawing in. Like, even in the last round, the people who were already locked for top eight still decided to play it out. And because of that, in the last round of Swiss, you and I got paired up against each other, and you scooped to me. I actually took second seed, so I got to be on the play at, like, both in top 8 and in top 4.
I have so much to say about that GPT. Like, this is what happens when you have a top 8 that was basically 5, maybe 6. I guess if, depending on how you want to qualify Jeskai, which is what Adrian played.
But
basically,
count?
5 or 6 red-white at mid-range. And that's basically the only deck that was successful at this GPT. That's basically the only deck that was in the top 8. I had several rounds where I'm going back and forth, watching matches, and it's just a wash. Everything is the same. You can't keep board states separate from each other. You can't keep cards. Because everybody is playing the same strategy and the same deck, and as a consequence, because you're just playing the mirror in the top eight, nobody wanted to intentionally draw into the lower half of the top eight. Everybody wanted to play out to finish in the top half of the top eight so you could go first in the mirror. And it was probably, no offense to you guys involved, the most boring GPT I've ever watched in my life because everyone was playing the mirror.
Okay, so I figured everybody would be on red-white for the GPT, so I decided to kind of homebrew. And we've been testing it online, and I think Will's actually tested it with us a few times. I think we took down a 5-3-2-2 with it on a Jeskai kind of burn list. And the reason I really was, like, all about that deck was Treasure Cruise. To be able to Treasure Cruise into, like, into card advantage and being able to have Jeskai Charm with Monastery Mentor tokens and Hordling Outburst tokens to kind of, like, gain that life back was just major. And then it just has the potential still to blow out people. So, I mean, it's really nice. I really had a blast with the deck. So, I don't know. Do you consider the red-white list kind of... Or Jeskai kind of like a red-white list?
I mean, it's probably not the same thing, but I think that... even if we did choose to qualify it as a completely different archetype, I mean, there's a lot of overlap in between the cards. But I think that even if it's a distinctive archetype, this top eight was just filled with aggressive strategies, a lot of paying attention to life totals, a lot of sequencing your burn spells. In some contexts, it's kind of interesting because you can see the players that have more experience with the mirror. Like when I got to watch Eric play in the top eight, I could see the different lines that he was taking and how he was aware of the fact that he was playing aggro mirrors all the time. So sometimes whether you're going first or second, and I guess we could talk about this later on the spike tip section, but sometimes whether you're going first or second will change your role even though you guys could be playing the exact same 75 cards. But I think for the most part, one of our top eight competitors, Justin Butt, was playing red-white splashing black for Crackling Doom and Sorin, which everyone tried really hard to convince him not to do. And in a way, you were splashing blue for Treasure Cruise and Mantis Rider, but they were very similar. There was a lot of, maybe not the same 75, but there was a lot of overlap in between those strategies. So I'll confess that, like, that might have been a slightly exaggerated position. Mirror matches can be interesting when players are aware of the mirror match and they play around it. But they're also less interesting if one of those players understands it's a mirror and the other player isn't quite sure what to do about it. Because then it's like bringing the whole knife to a gunfight thing. Like, that person understands that you change roles in the mirror and the other person is just not aware of that. So I think that when you have so much mirror match going on, you get the good stuff, you get the bad stuff. But at the end of the day, I came back home and I just had Rabble Masters just imprinted on my eyelids because it's all I'd seen all day.
I mean, that was an unfortunate event because it was mostly red-white decks. However, I think that that deck might not be very good anymore, especially after this weekend, just because of that green-white list that took first and second at the Star City Open this past weekend. I mean, that list, I feel like, just crushes the red-white decks, so... I know that me personally, I will move on to testing other strategies, like either Abzan, like I think I might go back to Abzan, or even to Blue-Black or Sultai Control, just to try out those strategies, because I'm still trying to figure out what I want to play for this regional PTQ, and trying to see what cards are coming out from this new set that will help me out. But before we move on to, like, spoilers and all that stuff, Will, you actually got to see one of my matches in the top eight, and I think you saw the entire match, right?
I think, depending on which one you're talking about, if it was... I usually try and bounce game to game if I get the opportunity to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you saw... I know you saw...
I think I probably saw, like, two or three, maybe. At least one, definitely.
Well, there was an issue that came up, and I had been doing it all day, and I only got called on it in the top eight, And this was whenever I casted a spell and I wanted to buy it back with Soulfire Grandmaster, I would pay Grandmaster's ability, I would activate his ability, as I cast the spell, and I got called on it, and I had been doing it all day, and I just, you know, it's good for me because I didn't know that, like, I hadn't read the card that closely and realized that you have to activate it before you actually cast the spell. However, because, like, my intentions were clear that, you know, that's what I wanted to do, and my opponent agreed that my intention was to buy back the spell, it didn't work against me. But what is your advice to people about stuff like that, Will?
So specifically on the subject of Soulfire Grandmaster, there's a mechanical reason why you need to do it in the correct order. And the mechanical reason is you activate Soulfire's ability to put an ability in the stack. And Soulfire has a static ability that says your spells have lifelink, right? Your burn spells. So if you activate the ability with the ability in the stack, your opponent can kill Soulfire Grandmaster. And upon killing Soulfire Grandmaster, you can use your burn spell now while it has lifelink, or you can let Soulfire die and then use it when you have the buyback effect resolved. But you have to make a choice. So if they respond to that ability by saying, I'm going to kill your source of lifelink, like in a mirror match, they're like wild slash your Soulfire, then with that ability on the stack, you actually have a decision to make. So if you choose to sequence things out of order, like it could vary what someone considers to be an appropriate out of order sequence. The important thing is that if you choose to vary it out of order, your opponent needs to be able to interact with it where they want to. So if you're sequencing it slightly out of order, that can't stop your opponent from interacting it at that exact spot. And they say, like, I want to kill it with the ability on the stack.
I gotcha. So then it forces you to choose whether or not you want to have lifelink or you want to actually buy back the spell. I getcha.
Right. And so the reason why I, with some of the spell stuff, why I think it, my inclination is to describe it as an out-of-order sequence is because there are two ways, basically, that you pay for the spell. So you can announce for the spell and pay for it as the spell resolves, or you can float mana and then say, I'm playing Stoke the Flames. So you can say, I'm Stoking the Flames, these are my targets, and then I'm going to pay mana, or you could say, I'm going to tap for 4 red, I'm going to cast Stoke the Flames, and I'm going to pay for it with the mana in my pool. So an example of where that can come up mechanically is with a card like Mana Barbs. So I think Mana Barbs is a card. Basically, Mana Barbs, or I think City of Rest will do it too, but they trigger when you tap the land. So if you tap to City of Rest, and they put that triggered ability in the stack, whenever City of Rest becomes tapped, it deals 1 damage to you. You can use, say, that red-white mana to cast a Lightning Helix, and helix your opponent for 3, gain 3 life, and then take the 2 damage from your City of Brass, which, let's say in this situation, doesn't kill you. But if you say, I'm casting Lightning Helix, cast Lightning Helix, I'm going to pay for it with these 2 City of Brass, I'll put Lightning Helix on the stack, paying red-white mana, but I'll put my City of Brass triggers on top of my Lightning Helix, and they'll deal 2 damage to me before I gain 3 life. So maybe in this situation, it kills me. So that, obviously that interaction is only going to show up with instants, but that would be like the mechanical reason why you should sequence Soulfire correctly so that your opponents are allowed to interact with your cards the way that they should be allowed to interact with. But I didn't suspect in that situation that you'd missed your trigger, you'd missed your opportunity. I thought mostly that it was clear that you were paying 8 mana via lands and convoke, and that you were casting that spell with pseudo buyback. And then as long as we understood what was going on, and as long as your opponent could burn in response, then I didn't have a problem with like where we landed.
Okay, fair enough. Well, thanks for your input on that, Will. So, What about you guys? Like, I spoke a lot about what I did. I know that, Adrian, you had a challenge to complete. How did that go?
So, I actually, I forget who it was. I think it was Ray Lonergan who challenged us last week to do, or 2 weeks ago to do the homebrew kind of challenge thing. And I decided to, well, he had asked if, like, a tier two or homebrew, and I decided to take makeshift over to modern about 2 weeks ago in El Paso, and the deck didn't do too great as well. Like, it took me to top four, but I still didn't like it very much. I don't know if I will be playing that deck again. It was the whole makeshift scapeshift kind of combo where you just cheat out an Emrakul or beat him with scapeshift, which is kind of a cool idea. It's just it's not as consistent as you would want it to be. So that was kind of an issue. Though I did get to play modern on this Friday or last Friday, I decided to kind of make more of a tokens, Boros kind of list with Monastery Mentor, Young Pyromancer, and Monastery Swiss Spear and, like, two Goblin Guides. And the whole idea of the deck was just to basically flood out my opponent with tokens, kind of start going at him. Did really good. I ended up losing in the final round of the FNM to Green-White Hate Bearers because Kitchen Finks is freaking annoying. And also, like, getting stuck on a land, cracking your fetch, and then the Aether Violin, what's that card? Leonin Arbiter? Don't ask me why I didn't... Yeah, I didn't...
You must pay two.
Oh, yeah. God, it was brutal. It was so bad. I didn't...
Surprise kitty.
Yeah, that was good. That was really good. But yeah, I had a blast. I still love Modern. I still had and I'm looking forward to playing some more this, hopefully this week. I know a buddy of mine, Sean Kendall, just finished Gifts Drawn. So I know I'll probably be testing against that this week. And I know there's a couple modern GPTs coming up, and any excuse, even though I got the buys this last weekend, I'm still probably going to attend it just to have the chance to play modern because it's so damn fun. But that's about all I did magic-wise and tournament-wise and spike tip-wise. Like, moral of the story is do not play decks you're unfamiliar with.
Alright. Well, speaking of playing decks you're unfamiliar with, I didn't really make it out to any paper tournaments this week, or past week, rather. Been really busy with school and work and stuff, and so actually I've been doing a lot of testing of Legacy with some friends and trying to decide on a new Legacy deck that I can build online, and hopefully be able to stream it for all the listeners out there. So I'm kind of stuck between a few different decks, but I'm trying to build something that's more than just Burn, which is probably the cheapest and most linear Legacy strategy available. So right now I'm thinking about building maybe a Tezzerator or a Mud-style deck that could be pretty cool to stream and hopefully be a little more interesting than Burn to watch, but it's been real fun testing and of course watching some of the coverage from the events this past weekend. So just keeping it casual but keeping it cool.
All right, awesome. So because we were gone last week, we missed out on an opportunity to talk about a lot of the spoilers that have come out from Dragons of Tarkir. So what we did was we picked just a few cards because we want to, once the full set is spoiled, we want to do a spoiler episode and just talk about all the cards that we think are going to be good or playable. But for this week, we're just going to pick a few and talk about them. So one of the cards that I want to talk about is the new Silumgar. Will actually had some great information as far as like the lore and the Vorthos Sea type stuff for Silumgar, and everyone's probably talked about it to extent by now, but I was actually really interested in it. So Will, if you want to tell everyone about it.
Yeah, I feel like at this point in time, everyone has heard about this, but if you did not know, it is your boy Tassiger hanging around Silumgar's neck. Big old bling of the former Sultai. leader. So you've got Silumgar on what is essentially, or what was once upon a time, Tassigar's throne room. So the room that he's in with the archway, that green coloration, that curvature is the same place that Dragon Lord Silumgar is. And where you would normally see the throne, you instead have a complete dragon horde. There was actually someone who posted on the Magic subreddit. It was really cool. He cosplayed, quote-unquote cosplayed as Silumgar by making a gold necklace that had a hard-cased Tassigar. And that was his Silumgar cosplay at PAX East.
Awesome. Okay, so we're going to do this real quick. Playable or unplayable? And why? Just a real quick reason from each of you. So, Adrian, Silumgar, playable or unplayable, and why?
Unplayable, because the other Silumgar is better.
Okay. Will?
Playable, because this effect, even if they have a removal spell, still generates a lot of tempo, and if they don't have a removal spell, is absolutely ludicrous. It's like answer or die.
Alright, Jay.
I'm gonna say playable, but very narrow, and reasons, it is too expensive, it's pretty expensive, and it's very weak to removal, so.
Okay, I'm gonna say it's very playable because of the ability that it has, very relevant and standard right now. Okay, so let's go to the next card. Let's talk about Dragon Lord Ojutai, the blue-white dragon. Real quick, Adrian, playable or unplayable, and why?
I'm gonna say playable because I think it's one of the closers that the blue-white control deck is needing right now.
Okay, Will?
I'm gonna say super playable. You basically have no window to kill it when it comes down. You're not attacking with it until you have counter spells to protect it. It draws you cards. I love flying dudes that draw you cards. That's what I want to play with my magical cards.
Okay, Jay?
Absolutely playable. The protection it has and the card advantage it generates is just great. I think it's, the cost is also very good for that size body and flying. So definitely playable for me.
Okay, good. And I think I'm gonna round it out and also say that it is very playable. The ability is relevant, again, in standard, and to Adrian's point, this is what blue-white control wants and needs. So this is a good card. Okay, quickly, let's go over the commands that we know about. There's four of them. Ojutai's command, Silumgar's command, Kolgan's command, Atarka's command. So for each one of them, playable or unplayable, and why, starting with Adrian, go.
I don't like Ojutai's command because of the inability to counter target whatever the other spell is. I think it's non-creature.
Non-creatures. It only counters creature spells.
Which is what I don't like about it. I think the card draw is relevant, but I don't know about the other two abilities of gaining life. Atarka's command, in my opinion, is awesome. It's a Skullcrack, which we need to deal with those Siege Rhinos and all the other stuff. You can put a land card down. There's quite a bit going on with it. Not too into Silumgar's command, though I do like the fact that it destroys a Planeswalker. And Kolligan's command, not as impressed with it as... I don't really see myself playing it.
Okay, so none of them are playable to you, except for Atarka's.
No, I think Atarka's command is insane. I think that card will see a lot of play. I'm not a fan of Ojutai's command, because I'm jaded from Cryptic Command.
All right, Will?
Atarka's is not playable in Standard until the format changes and people actually want to play Red-Green Aggro. Much more playable in Modern. Kolaghan's command probably needs a format change to be playable, but it's an absolute nightmare. This is the last card I want to play against if I'm playing an aggro deck. I don't want my creatures to die and to discard cards. Silumgar's command, absolutely playable. There's already a deck that wants this card, whether it's blue-black or it winds up being Esper. This is the blue command. It's really, really strong. It's the best follow-up, in my opinion, to my favorite card in the set. Ojutai's command, only playable, maybe in blue-white heroic. I don't think this is the control command. I probably would consider playing a copy or so in blue-white because there's a little bit different applications. If you can't return a creature consistently, whether it's heroic creature or its name is Snapcaster Mage, this card is unplayable.
Okay, Jay?
Atarka's command, I'm going to say unplayable in standard, but definitely playable in modern. Right now, there's no home for it in standard. There, like Will said, There's just no red-green aggro shell that needs this type of utility. Kolaghan's command, I'm gonna say, pretty much unplayable. I don't think it's good enough. Just compare to Blightning from a few sets ago and you'll see it's just not good enough. Silengar's command, I think, playable. It's a little conditional, especially I'm not sure if it'll be mainboardable. Definitely a sideboard option. Because if you don't have targets, it's very easy for it to whiff. And Ojitai's command, I'm gonna say unplayable in standard, but I'm gonna reach out and say very playable in modern. I'd like to see this card see a little bit of play in red, white, blue control in modern. I think it's gonna be pretty interesting to see where it goes.
Interesting. Okay. So my thoughts on the commands: Ojitai's command, playable as a sideboard card in standard, definitely playable in modern. Silmgar's command, definitely playable in standard. Kolaghan's command, probably playable in standard, but it needs a deck around it. Atarka's command also needs a deck around it in standard. Could be good in standard. We'll also definitely see play in modern. Okay, so let's move on to the two planeswalkers that we know about. What do we think of Narset? Go ahead, Adrian.
Narset is insane. I love Narset. If we would have posted the podcast from last week, I would have said, called it. But super into it. I really like everything about the card. Sarkhan, on the other hand, not too impressed. I do like the fact that he comes down and blocks for himself. And I guess the plus one is fine. I don't really see myself playing him, and I don't know if he's gonna see too much play. The rug kind of requirement might hurt. I don't know.
I want the record to show that I like Narset more than Adrian does. Narset is insane.
What in the? You do not say
ludicrous.
That.
Ludicrous. This is so good. I alluded to it earlier. All I want to do is play Esper Control and play Narset, draw Silumgar's command, minus Narset and Silumgar's command my helpless opponent twice. That's all I really want to do, is just kill, like, two creatures and a planeswalker and bounce their land. But she's really strong. There's a lot of applications. Little non-bow with counterspell, but super upside with a lot of other cards. Sarkhan, I'm just going to come out and say, just unplayable. I don't think that if you're ever in these colors, you want a 5-mana planeswalker that threatens to draw a single card a turn. I think that's a huge investment. I think that the applications for adding a single mana to your mana pool are pretty thin. I think that the token-making ability is fine. It's a bunch of okay abilities and Dragonstorm, but I think the bar for what 5-mana man investments get you is so high at this point with Stormbreath Dragon that, or other Sarkhan, that, no, this, the name is wrong. The Sarkhan is not broken at all.
Okay, Jay?
Well, I'm gonna say, I think Narset is a lot stronger than Sarkhan Unbroken. Her loyalty and cost are just so much more in line with where you want to be in standard right now. I don't think her plus one and minus two are super overpowered, which is fine since she only costs four. I don't know. I wish her minus nine was a little more impactful. I mean, it is definitely impactful. Don't get me wrong, but, when you have I don't know. I guess she's just not the most broken planeswalker, which is fine. And same with Sarkhan. I think it's kind of the same boat. They're both going to be fine in standard. I think even Sarkhan Unbroken will see standard play. But they're not going to be the next Jace the Mind Sculptor. So I wouldn't really expect either of these to see modern play. So we'll just see where they go. But she's definitely better than Sarkhan. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, I think Narset is amazing, and again, is gonna see a lot of play in standard. I think that it'll be utilized very well in a control deck, either blue-white or Esper. And she may even see play in modern, I'm just not sure yet, but the blue-white control deck might actually want her. As far as Sarkhan goes, I am not very pleased with this Sarkin. He's only okay in my book. And I had mentioned it to the guys earlier that at 5 mana for a Sarkin, I'd rather be just playing the mono red Sarkin. So we're going to move on real quick to the last couple of cards that we want to talk about. First one is Haven of the Spirit Dragon. This is the land that lets you return dragon cards or Ugin from your graveyard to your hand. What do you guys think about this, Adrian?
Seems playable to me. I kind of like the idea of land. I can see it as a one or two of in control decks, or maybe a two of in those reanimator decks. I feel like reanimator with some of the new cards could be a thing.
What makes me curious, because we're starting to see more cards, we have a Wall of Omens-esque card that is only a flying Wall of Omens if you reveal a dragon. I think that I'm awfully curious if the dragon deck, if you will receive enough support to function, or if it won't. I feel like if it doesn't, I don't know if this is ever better than a basic. Like, it can be problematic in your openers, so I don't really know if this is what I want from a singleton land, if I'm not playing mini dragons, mini whelps.
Alright, well, I think I kind of agree with Will. I think it's pretty narrow. I mean, it's very narrow. It says, you know, there's not many cards that reference specific cards right on them, and the ability to return Ugin Planeswalker and dragons that you may mill away is pretty situational in even in the whip deck, I think. And if you, like Will said, if you draw it in your opening hand, you're kind of, it's pretty bad. So, I don't know. Well, time will tell. I mean, people are definitely going to test with this card, but we'll see how impactful it actually is. I mean, at the end of the day, all it is doing is you still have to go down a land just to return one card from your graveyard to your hand. So, I'm not sure. I don't think it's that great.
Okay, I think this card is really good. The control decks really want it because most of them are already playing Ugin, and then they're also already going to be playing some number of dragons as finishers. So this card just kind of helps get them back in case you need to wipe the board, or if you need to, or if they can get rid of your Ugin. It's really, really good. I also think that it's going to probably see, it's definitely going to see a lot of play in other formats like EDH or even Cube. I could see it being good in like a dragon based cube. So this card could see some play in other formats. I don't see it seeing play in like Modern or Legacy though. And then the last couple of cards that we want to talk about are Anticipate. I really like this card. I think it's going to be good. It's very much needed in the blue decks, because blue's been getting so hosed lately. This is finally a pretty decent draw spell that we want. What do you guys think real quick, Adrian?
I really like it. I think we don't have to play Divination anymore to draw some cards, and I think it's going to see a 4 of play in a lot of decks, mainly just the control ones, though.
Okay, Will?
I think that this is a clear sign that Wizards traveled back in time to convince that kid from across the street to convince his parents not to copulate, and then now we're living in the future where that kid was never born. And so now you actually get to enjoy your blue cards because Sarkin traveled through time to will that punk out of existence.
All right. Jay.
I think this card is pretty good. I mean, obviously it's very reminiscent of Telling Time. So maybe that's kind of fits in with the time travel. I think it's definitely going to see standard play. One of the best, blue commons, and unlike a lot of things we've been seeing, not completely broken. So I kind of like the power level of Anticipate. I think it's pretty fine. Definitely cool. Is going to see play.
Good. All right, and then I want to give notable mention to the art on Evolving Wilds. Best Evolving Wilds art ever? Question mark.
I like it.
It's really great. It's pretty great.
There are two arts, right? There's this art, and then from, I think this is promotional.
Innistrad. There's an Innistrad art that I like a lot as well.
Right, but is there only one art for Evolving Wilds in Dragons of Tarkir, or is there another one? Because I thought I remembered reading something about maybe Titus doing one, but I'm not sure. This art is incredible. I mean, without a doubt.
Yeah, this art's really good. I don't think Evolving Wilds was printed in any other set in this block. Is that what you're saying, Will?
No, I might have seen a... There is a different version of it. Yeah, there's a different version of this. Noah Bradley did it. I don't know. I think it's the pack. There's a series of slightly different at the pre-release.
Oh,
so there's
yeah.
a Noah Bradley Evolving Wilds. If you get the opportunity to look at this, it's amazing. That this is the best one that we've seen in a set, but Noah Bradley's Evolving Wilds is amazing. It's just outright one of the best land arts I think I've ever seen. It's really, really cool. So this is like two straight home runs on art resources for the same card.
I'm looking at it right now, Will, and the art looks very, very similar to like Tectonic Edge. Like at real quick glance, I just see Tectonic Edge.
But it's not Tectonic Edge.
No, I know, but it's like real quick glance, I saw Tectonic Edge and I was like, oh, Evolving Wilds. But I do think that the art for the one that's in the set itself, by Andrea Rocha, I think her name is way better. It's a really beautiful piece of art. I like it a lot. I would actually get a print of this art. That's how nice it is. All right, so.
Well, real quickly, I'm just gonna comment.
Okay.
I don't like the Rise of the Eldrazi art, which has been, like, the go-to Evolving Wilds art on, like, about a million reprints. Since this gets into a lot of dual decks and, pre-cons and stuff. I've always liked the, Dark Ascension art but that was more of a flavorful fit for Innistrad. But I think this last art, that's just gonna be the regular Dragons of Tarkir art has been the best representation of Evolving Wilds I've seen. And hopefully it will be the new go-to art for Evolving Wilds, because I'm getting a little tired of the, like, Rise of the Eldrazi art, where I can't even really tell what's going on. Like, there's trees kind of separating from themselves, and, yeah. The new art is great. Just great.
Okay, so that's a little quick hit at our spoilers of Dragons of Tarkir for now. We're going to talk more about it as the full set is spoiled for us, which will be next week. So, next week we're going to give our real quick hits on all the cards in the set. But moving on, there's been a couple of announcements since we've been away. Recently, Wizards did a panel at PAX East over in Boston, and they gave us a bunch of stuff. On top of the spoilers that they gave us for Dragons of Tarkir, they also announced a couple of spoilers for Modern Masters 2015. So we're going to see the return of two fan favorites. The first one being Karn Liberated. This card definitely needed to be reprinted. It was already driving way high in terms of price. And we're also seeing the return of Tarmogoyf. So I'm going to be able to get my Goyfs on the cheap now. What do you guys think of these reprints?
I think they're fantastic. I'm not personally much of a Karn Liberated fan, but I think it's just great to see him reprinted. He was kind of like that one of powerful colorless planeswalker before Ugin, and you know his price reflected that, and I think a reprint for him is pretty good. And of course, personally, I can't get enough of a Tarmogoyf reprint. I don't think it's like a card you should ever be thinking is going to go on any kind of reserved list. I mean, he's just too good, and seeing him reprinted is great news. I think a lot of people are going to be happy about that.
I think that the Karn father will note your lack of faith, but it's exactly what you want. I mean, for them to announce reprints, these are the things that you want them to say that they're reprinting, to hit all of the... These are probably the most important things that you could come right out and announce. Like, there's some things that, obviously, we still want to see Mox Opal. We still want to see maybe Vendilion click, but to very quickly come out and announce that you're reprinting Tarmogoyf is fantastic news. To make sure that people know that some of the slightly more recent but still expensive cards like Karn, you know, other than Etched Champion, which is fine to have like an art update, our three confirmed reprints outside of that are Imrakul, Karn, and Tarmogoyf. So I think that you could not ask for a better, basically, three cards. I mean, you could include something else, but this is what you want. Like, they're not coming forward and saying, I jokingly, everyone who was asking for Tarmogoyf, I would jokingly tell them that the green mythic in Modern Masters 2 is going to be Thrun, the last troll, as the ultimate troll instead of Tarmogoyf. But to just end my future trolling opportunities prematurely and just come right out and say that there's another Tarmogoyf reprint, I think it's what you want. Like, availability issues, they're gonna happen. Is everyone gonna wanna get their hands on this set? Yeah. Is it gonna be the hypest GP ever? Yeah. But, I mean, you can't really ask for more.
Alright, so what other cards do we think are getting reprinted in the set? I, for one, am fairly certain we're gonna see, Inquisition of Kozilek. We're probably going to see Serum Visions, and we're probably going to see Remand. As far as any rares go, I'd like to see Noble Hierarch, and I'd also like to see Fulminator Mage. What are you guys expecting?
I think that we're probably going to see Fulminator Mage. I would really, really like to see a Noble Hierarch reprint. She's been dodging for a while. When was Noble Hierarch released? When did she come out?
Shards of Alara, or Conflicts, yeah, Conflicts, around 2008, 2009.
Okay, no so reference. They would have to do it. They would have to do it in the Modern Masters, because there's no way it'd be in Zendikar. For some reason I thought she was in Zendikar.
She's one of those cards that's a lot like Damnation, in that she skirted by a couple of reprint opportunities. I know that a lot of people thought there was a chance that when they released the shard color commander decks, that Derevi's deck or Rune's deck, that Bant colored deck, there was a lot of people that suspected that that deck was going to have a Noble Hierarch in it, and that was a missed opportunity. Damnation was a missed opportunity in the mono black commander deck, so I think that right now, that's got to be the card. Damnation has to be the card that people are the most antsy about. When do you reprint Damnation?
Alright, Jay, what are you wanting to see reprinted in this set?
Well, I would like to see Dark Confidant reprinted at rare. I think that's appropriate for his power level. I mean, that'd be my dream. I know it's not gonna happen. I know Wizards is just not gonna do that, but that would be the dream for me. I don't think he's mythic. That's just an opinion, but other cards, I guess, I don't know. I'd like to see Remand and certainly Serum Visions get reprinted. I don't know. I'm more wanting to be surprised. I think now that Tarmogoyf has been confirmed, I can deal with just about anything getting reprinted in the other slots, so I'll just have to wait and see.
Okay. Now, are we expecting a Vendilion Click reprint? I, for one, am hoping for one, but I don't think that it's very likely. What do you guys think?
I wouldn't put money on V-Click. I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of a problem they've created with Mythic, where it feels like now that they've determined that certain cards that used to be rare are now Mythic, they have really limited slots to reprint them, and I think it's a little problematic for cards that, you know, are seeing big availability issues. So, I'd love to see it reprinted, but, I don't think it's likely. I think maybe Cryptic Command might be reprinted. I don't know. We'll see.
I think when we talked about it earlier, I at least mentioned some sort of point that the first Modern Masters set had a cycle of mythics that the dragons from Kamigawa, that a lot of people suspected there might be a mirror cycle in this Modern Masters set where we saw Praetors which would let you hit good reprint targets like Elishnorn, in addition to hitting some other cards that are maybe less desirable, but certainly are not the worst things. But I think that Jay has a point that there's a limited number of slots that you could qualify as reprint slots. So there's certainly going to be more colorless. There might not be more colorless mythics, but I don't think that we're going to see sort of Feast and Famine, sort of Body and Mind, sort of War and Peace. I don't think we see one sword without seeing all of them. So I think we just see no swords in this set. And instead, we'll see different colorless mythics. So in the first Modern Masters, we had Vedalken Jackals. We had Sword of Light and Shadow, Sword of Fire and Ice. I think this set, we're probably seeing Emrakul, Karn, Mox Opal are probably some of the most likely candidates to be there. But there's a limited number. There's only going to be 15 mythics in the set. So thumbs up for the Tarmogoyf reprint, but we won't see all of the mythics from this set be the exact same mythics from the previous one, because there are still other cards that need to be reprinted.
I think at the end of the day, when you kind of start looking at all the things that can be reprinted in Modern Masters, there's a ridiculous amount of cards that can be. I'm gonna throw out that I think the two that I want to see and that I think have the most opportunity to be reprinted, I think Splinter Twin and Scapeshift will probably get reprints. I think we'll probably even see a Velocute in the land. As for lands in general, I think instead of fetches, we're probably going to see man lands, and there's a high chance that we'll see filter lands. So that's just my two cents.
Okay, cool. So at this PAX panel that Wizards was at, they also announced Magic Origins, which it had been announced before, but they actually gave us a spoiler this time. And we got our first creature planeswalker. It was Liliana. She flips from her creature version over to the planeswalker version, and it looks like all of the planeswalkers in this set are going to be like that. They're going to start out as creatures, and then something's got to happen in order for them to flip over to a planeswalker. Now, I was under the impression that Wizards said that they made a mistake with flip cards and that they wouldn't do it again. I don't know if they intentionally made them this way, or if that was even said by them, or how people are going to react to these. I don't know what to think of Liliana. Like, for one, I don't think that she's very good as a creature, and she's way, like, for her to flip over is way too easy for it to happen. And I don't think that she's that great as a planeswalker either. So what do you guys think?
Well, they definitely didn't say that it was a mistake. I think that they said if there's the storm scale, how likely mechanics are, flip cards were pretty much guaranteed as a difficult to do, but absolutely going to happen again, because they knew that there was design space. They said specifically that, like, the transformation mechanic in Innistrad helped establish this theme of horror, and it kind of signified these changes in plot, but that they knew there was another way to do it. I think it's cool to see this card. What worries me about this card is that the implication seems to be that all five of them are going to be creatures that transform into planeswalkers. And I don't know how rich that design space is. It seems like they're going to be creatures. They're going to have some trigger that causes them to flicker out and come back in as a planeswalker. And that trigger will be related to their storyline. So Liliana losing a family member is kind of the storyline thing that is represented on her card, where another non-token creature you control dies. And she resurrects it as a zombie, basically, or she fails to save it. I don't know. I mean, we don't necessarily know what ignites everybody else's spark necessarily. So it'll be interesting to see how much design space there actually is. I think one of the cool ones, since we probably already know ballpark where it's going to be, is that we know that Gideon's spark was ignited when he killed someone much more powerful than him. So it's highly likely that something involving creature combat is going to be the trigger to transform Gideon from Creature to Planeswalker. It's cool. I have to agree with Eric. I think that when I look at this card, I'm not fully convinced, and I know that this is a high bar, but I'm not fully convinced that the flip side of this Liliana is actually better than Liliana the Veil. And you have to jump through a hoop to get this card to be the Planeswalker, and then I'm not convinced. Like, it's not a bad card. I think I would just play it outright if it didn't have the make me flip to be a Planeswalker clause, but I'm certainly worried that it's not stellar. Like, it's fine. I like the grind discard. But without a reanimate strategy, I think that it's really hard to exploit this card.
Yeah, I agree. I just don't think it's good. I mean, it's not a good card. At the end of the day, this type of flip mechanic is just not good enough. I think there's a lot of things that can just kill her when she comes into play. It's her, when she flips, she's not especially strong. Her minus X and her minus 8 are both very, narrow. They're not, you know, Liliana of the Veil does not have a narrow minus, think minus 6. She completely massacres the opponent when she goes minus. This Liliana just kind of, it's more like a minor annoyance. I think even Sorin, Solemn Visitor has a better emblem than this. So, I don't know. I mean, I think if they're not strong, you know, people, you know, there's always been mythics like Godsire that are not good, but you understand why they're mythic. I mean, it's Godsire. It's like a humongous 8/8 that taps and puts 8/8s into play. And like, I think everyone, including like, Timmies are the guys who like big creatures. I mean, I think everyone's getting why the card's mythic, but I mean, I'm just not getting why this card is mythic. I mean, other than that, it's a planeswalker, and that they've established every planeswalker needs to be mythic.
It's a creature that transforms into another. Like, that is crazy. I think these are the most justifiably mythic planeswalkers, because they start out as creatures, have a trigger, and literally change card type, and come back in with entirely new art, with entirely new abilities, loyalty counters. I think these are, like, maybe back in Lorwyn you were like, why is this? Well, I mean, they were rare then. But maybe with some of the first ones, why are they mythic? But, I mean, they change card types. That has to be awe-inspiring.
I disagree. I'm not inspired. I honestly feel like, I guess my point is, Godsire feels more mythic than Liliana, Heretical Healer. For real. Godsire is just so much more mythic. I don't know how to explain it. This card just does not make an impact for me. I just wish it wasn't a truism that every planeswalker had to be mythic. I don't feel like that needs to be a thing, but maybe I'm just crazy.
All right, so are you guys there?
Yes.
I am.
Okay.
No, I left.
I got a notification that the call.
I got a momentary blink cast upon me.
I think Adrian realized that we're just at a much higher level of magical understandings than him. And so he just decided that he'd had enough.
Actually, I think he just had a paper to type, so he had to go.
No, I think it's what I said.
Okay, so let's move on to the last announcement they made, which was the fall block will be returned to Zendikar. So this is something that a lot of people are really looking forward to. I don't know if it's because they think that they're going to reprint fetch lines in here, or it's because of the actual lore of the storyline that has to do surrounding Zendikar itself. For those who don't know, and maybe Will can explain it better because he's really good at this, but for those who don't know, or didn't play at this time, the Eldrazi took over the plane of Zendikar, and Gideon was forced to leave, and he promised to come back to Zendikar with the help of other planeswalkers to help defeat the Eldrazi. Does that about sum it up, Will?
Yeah, basically a lot of our main characters were on Zendikar at that time period, and when the Eldrazi are released, basically everybody comes to the conclusion that this fight is too big and they need help. So a lot of the plot that we've actually had since that point stemmed from people going to find help. So Jace, who was also on Zendikar, we saw his card in Wildrake as Jace the Mind Sculptor. Jace went to Ravnica to seek help from the Izzet Guild. Gideon went to Ravnica to seek help from the Boros Legion. Elspeth, I think that's the event that spurs Elspeth to go to Mirrodin. There's a lot of the places that we've gone to are actually kind of results of people trying to figure out what they're going to do about these immense interdimensional Lovecraftian horrors.
Okay, so, like you said, Elspeth went to Mirrodin, and then she also went to Theros, right? And then Ajani, was also on that plane as well. And then, Gideon is actually from Theros, so I don't know if he has anything to do with that. And then the whole time, Liliana was just hunting Garrick, right?
So Liliana's plot has mostly centered around, and we'll get into the origins, we'll focus a little bit more on this, but she's a pre-mending planeswalker, which means she and Sorin are basically of the current planeswalkers, the oldest ones that we really know. I guess Mechabolas. But her storyline kind of centers around the fact that she basically, for eternal youth or such, has promised pieces of her soul to various demons. And in her very Liliana conniving way, she is actively seeking to destroy the demons that she owes parts of her soul to. So that's where she gets the Chain Veil. That's why she goes to Innistrad. Her actually purpose that she travels to Innistrad is to convince Thalia to open the Hell Vault, not because she cares about Avacyn, not because she cares about the humans or the people of the plane of Innistrad, but because Griselbrand is one of the demons that she promised part of her soul to, so that she can just blow Griselbrand up. So her storyline has kind of focused on a lot of those things, but she's had this run-in with Garrick where she stepped on a plant or something, I don't know, hurt Garrick's feelings, and Garrick has been hunting her since their altercation on Innistrad, which left him, Garrick, the Veil Cursed, and then eventually Garrick, Apex Predator. But that's kind of derived from messing with Liliana's business.
Ah, okay. So do we think that in this set we're going to see, like, just a slew of planeswalkers because that's what the storyline calls for? Or do we think that it's just going to be our core planeswalkers plus a bunch of powerful spells that were acquired in these various planes that they traveled to while seeking help?
I think it's entirely possible that Magic Origins is focusing on these characters so that we could actually just see the five Magic Origins planeswalkers or some large portion of them immediately show up right back in Battle for Zendikar. We're definitely going to see Gideon twice. Gideon is in our first art for Battle for Zendikar. I don't think that it'd be extremely unlikely to not see Nissa because it's her home plane. So I think it's entirely possible with Chandra and Jace. All these characters have been involved with Zendikar before. So I think it's possible that Magic Origins is going to focus on character development for them, establish who they are, and then we're just going to see them again in the very next set.
Okay. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. So, final question. When are we going to see Fetchlands, the enemy-colored Fetchlands? Are we going to see them in the Zendikar block? Are we going to see them in Origins? Do we see them reprinted in Modern Masters 2015? Or do we still see them possibly show up in Fate Reforged? What do you guys think?
My sincere hope is that they're in Modern Masters. I know that probably means that their price doesn't dip as much as some people would want them to, but Wizards has acknowledged that there are legitimate concerns with fetch lands being ever-present in Standard. It definitely affects the length of things. We saw earlier in the fall, it definitely affects the opportunity for people to cheat. So I think that if they reprint them in Battle for Zendikar, there is a period of time where we absolutely have overlap and there are 10 fetches in Standard, and I think that's gross. Like, I don't think that that's desirable. I don't think that's something we want at all. But I think for the most part, like, them in the same Standard is a recipe for disaster. They do need to be reprinted. I think Modern Masters is the best slot for the reprint.
I'm gonna actually say, like, probably, I think the most likely reprint spot is during Return to Zendikar. I mean, it just makes sense. That's where they came from, and I think that's where they'll be reprinted, and maybe there'll be some overlap in Standard, but, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I guess it doesn't really matter to me where they get reprinted. I think just as long as they get reprinted at some point, I'll be happy. I think the opportunity to cheat because fetch lands are present in the format, I don't think that could be too big of a consideration not to want to print them. But even if they show up in the last core set, I think people will be happy about it. So, I don't know. To me, I guess it doesn't matter. I mean, even if they're in Dragons of Tarkir, I'd be plenty happy. I think fetch lands, I think it's a fun mechanic. I think fetch lands have always been fun, and getting access to the other five we've been missing for a while is going to be a good thing.
Okay, so I think we're all expecting them. We just don't know where they're going to show up. So, the last thing that I want to speak about today is our latest spike tip. So this spike tip was submitted by Ed Green, and he writes, how do I sideboard correctly? How does it change between play and draw? So I want to start off and say, sideboarding has become kind of like a big deal when it comes to tournament play. You really need to know what cards are good against certain matchups, and when they're good, whether it's on the play or on the draw, how many of them you want to put in, and how many or what cards you want to take out also. So, I mean, that's just the core of what sideboarding is. Now, a lot of net decks are put out, and then various pros will write about these decks, and some of them will actually include sideboard strategies. That doesn't always mean that you should steer towards these sideboard strategies, because sometimes you might see something, you know, a little bit different that you might want to sideboard for. But I think that for the most part, these sideboard strategies are a good baseline to base your sideboarding strategies off of. So when you're looking at how you want to sideboard, you really want to look at what the strengths and weaknesses are of your deck in a particular matchup. So we'll use an example of the red-white deck, which I piloted this past weekend, and I took to the GPT. When I played against a mirror, I didn't want any chain to the rocks in my deck, solely because there's nothing quite big enough that I want to chain, and typically the deck wants to only put out one threat at a time and make you deal with those threats until you can deal with them, and then they just put out another threat. And then all in the meanwhile, they have the opportunity to burn you out. So Chain to the Rocks is not really a very good card. Also, Whirling Outburst is also not a very good card, because we know that that deck has Arc Lightning on the sideboard and sometimes even Anger of the Gods. So those cards are the ones that I knew that I was always going to be taking out against the mirror. And what I would be putting in are other cards that are a little bit more resilient in the mirror. So cards like Sarkhan, cards like Stormbreath Dragon, and cards like Ashcloud Phoenix. Those are all cards that I would bring in against the mirror because I knew that they would be better. Now, the numbers kind of varied a little bit whether I was on the play or not, because when I'm on the play, I definitely want to land a 5-drop first before my opponent, so I jam all my 5-drops in there. But when I'm on the draw, sometimes the additional Stormbreath Dragons aren't that great, and you want to have a little bit more burn, so you want to keep more burn in than you wouldn't. So that's just some of the stuff that I do that I look at when I know that I'm on the player on the draw, and I know my deck. The other importance is not only knowing your deck, but knowing your opponent's deck, what it wants to do, how it works, and how it interacts with your deck. When you get to know all of these things, sideboarding becomes a lot easier. So my advice to those of you who are looking to sideboard a little bit better, start looking into sideboard strategies if they're available. Also look into what weaknesses are against top-tier decks that you expect to face in a tournament, and see how you can exploit any of these weaknesses. That would be where I start when it comes to sideboarding. What do you think, Will?
I think that it's going to vary based on decks. Like, you specifically have been playing a lot of red-white, so you actually get to enjoy what is frequently the best sideboard color, which is oftentimes white is actually the best sideboard. But a good way to look at it is to kind of consider the sideboard not as this other deck, but they're part of your deck. They're just, you get to play the best 60 in any given game, but you actually have a 75-card deck. So when you construct sideboards, you get to choose some of those high-risk, high-reward, really good in a particular matchup, not good in another matchup type cards. So the sideboard is got a lot of those, like, swing-for-the-fence cards. You know, when, like, Erase is probably one of the simplest examples. When Erase is good, Erase is amazing. But if your opponent has no enchantments, it's terrible. I think that you mentioned the kind of play draw, or might have alluded to the play draw effect. I think that we mentioned it earlier, but a lot of that I think boils down to the shifting roles dynamic, that a lot of the times in a mirror match, if your opponent goes first, particularly like the easiest example is this red-white deck, if your opponent goes first, then chances are they are going to land the first creature. So if you're, for example, playing a version of red-white that doesn't play 4 Wild Slash, like let's say you have some split main and side, Wild Slash spikes in value when you're allowed to play it on, say, turn 2 or turn 1 to kill their 2-drop. Like, one of the best tempo plays in that mirror match is when your opponent plays an untapped land on 2 and plays Soulfire or Seeker of the Way, and you get to, with your 1 mana, Wild Slash it and then untap and then play your threat, and now suddenly you've taken initiative on the board. So I think that, like, in that deck specifically, I think that's a big example of the tempo swing. I think that if you, outside of the mirror, if you play Abzan or something, Valorous Stance is a big example of a card that changes a little bit of value when it's regaining you tempo. But I think that those are the kinds of situations where you can take advantage of some of those cheap spells to swing the tempo advantage back in your favor. Maybe an example of a card that the tempo advantage is less present or not present on the card at all is if you're playing a mirror match, it's obviously very good to resolve Outpost Siege because drawing cards in the mirror is really good, but it's definitely really bad to have your opponent in the red-white mirror play an Outpost Siege on their turn 4 and then for you to untap and play your own Outpost Siege, because there's this high likelihood that your opponent might kill your Outpost Siege before you get to draw any cards. So I think that's an example where the card's good in the mirror match, but it's absolutely not what you want to be doing on turn 4 to follow up your opponent's turn 4 play.
Okay, Jay, do you have any input?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, basically, like, my philosophy with sideboarding is it's all about knowing, it's all about, you know, you're not, like, I guess, your greater game knowledge, your knowledge of formats, your knowledge of decks, and just the amount of research that you're going to put into what you're playing against. I mean, sideboarding, it's actually kind of about knowing your opponent's deck, not even about knowing your own deck. So I think the more time you're willing to spend seeing what other people are playing is going to help you in your own sideboarding. So my first step would be to do the research and see what, you know, what other decks you're going to be playing against. And my next step would be, you know, knowing which cards effectively answer those types of strategies. I mean, it seems simple, but those two things put together, it's going to help you in a lot of situations, and especially in situations where you think, like, oh, I've never seen this deck, but if you can relate it to something you have seen, you know, like, oh, that's weird. He's playing some kind of, like, red-green aggro deck. I don't really see that often. But if you can relate it to, you know, another deck that you are prepared for or that you have studied, you're going to be able to, like, synthesize those similarities and find the responses you need. So, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's a little shameful for me to say, I kind of just wing it. But the reason I wing it is because I put in the time just mulling over every single other deck list that I can see. And really doing the research is what really helps me decide which cards I'm going to need to bring in and which ones I'm going to need to take out. And, of course, like Will said, you know, certain cards aren't always going to be, you know, there is one thing I think people forget, which is whether you're on the player draw, how that's going to affect your sideboarding. And you gotta just be conscious of, how going on the draw is gonna make a card like Outpost Siege in the Mirror not that great. You know, more likely you're gonna wanna just answer their Outpost Siege that's coming first. And that play is probably gonna generate more advantage than following up with your own. So, there's a lot that goes into sideboard, and I'm sure there's whole articles written on it that are more eloquent than I am, but, really, you know, out of game knowledge is going to help you in game, so you can't ever really discount it too much.
Okay, this is all very good advice and input from you guys. I appreciate it. And hopefully this helped you out a little bit, Ed Green. And remember, if you want to submit a spike tip of your own for us to discuss and talk about, you can always do that and submit it over to the Mana Spike Gmail, and we'll address it for you. So, I think that's about it for this week, guys. What I wanted to talk about real quick was just that, you know, we are blessed to have our podcast uploaded every week for you guys to listen to over at the MTG Cast Network, over at mtgcast.com. Those guys do a great job of what they do and putting out great content every week for you guys to listen to. So, if you have a chance, be sure to donate and subscribe to all your favorite podcasts and continue to listen. The other thing I want to talk about is our friends of the show, Roberto Gonzalez and Brandon Remley, have started up their own podcast, and that podcast is called MTG Focus. They are also on the MTG Cast Network, and we will definitely support them in their ventures, and we highly recommend that you guys go check them out, because they have been blowing it out of the park. They just released their first episode last week, and their first episode featured Paulo Vito as well as Adrian Sullivan, and they talked about a lot of great things. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, make sure you go check them out. And for us, you can always find us on the Mana Spike Twitter as well as our Facebook page. Links will be in the show notes. And you can find me on Twitter at MrE234, all one word. What about you, Jay?
As always, follow me on Twitter at WolfgangAN, at Wolfgangen, and hopefully I'll entertain you for a moment.
All right, what about you, Will?
You can find me at HK Isn't Korea, and I have no intention of entertaining you. So don't expect any funny business.
It's too bad that Adrian isn't here, because I'm sure he would get a kick out of it, because he seems to always forget that that's your Twitter handle.
Yeah, every week, like, he has selective memory, even though it's just to make fun of him. And despite, like, what's baffling, for people who don't know, what's baffling to me that he made that mistake is that he studied abroad in South Korea, and that's what's so confusing to me.
Yeah, but now that you say that, I remember, yeah.
But every week he's just like, oh my god, that's so funny, and I'm like, well, now it's not funny anymore, Adrian. Now it's just kind of sad.
Poor Adrian, he's not even here to defend himself.
Good.
Not that he would do a good job at it.
Anyway. Get in extra digs. He'd probably just laugh.
All right, so coming up, I know that we have a couple of GPTs that we're getting ready to play in that are going to be for Las Vegas, and then we have a couple of other tournaments coming up. I know that I have the regional PTQ coming up in just a little over a month, so I'm going to be working hard at testing for that, and I hope to do well for you guys. And then we have Grand Prix Vegas coming up also. There's a lot going on, guys.
Definitely. I'm excited.
Yeah, so make sure you guys stay tuned to the Man of Spike podcast, and we'll see you all next week.